This afternoon is June 21st, 1978. I'm seated in my office in the college library, and across from me is W.A. Rice, more familiarly known as Bill, who was chairman of the geology department. Rocky, all right. And who has, who retired, what, 2 years?
3 years.
3 years ago. Time gets away.
Sure
but
does.
But has still been on campus. He's a fixture here at the college. I want to talk with him about how he, a little bit about his background, how he came here, and some of his experiences on the campus. Let's start off first. Did you grow up in Delaware, Bill?
Delaware, Ohio.
Yes.
Clarity.
All right.
And Ohio Wesleyan. And Yale. 2 years at Utah State Ag, where you were supposed to vote yacht in faculty meeting, and I voted as I darn pleased. That's only 2 years.
You haven't changed.
Why should I?
I answered.
And a year with Shell Oil Company. A year at Chapel Hill, and that was the winter of Pearl Harbor, so I went to the TBA labs, and then I started fishing for a small college in near Ohio. After some preliminary flirtations, here I am.
Okay. Well, when I was in college here, one of the teachers, although she was in administration, was Sarah Stevenson. I took history with Sarah, and a couple of years after you were here, I happened to run into her, and she mentioned something about, said, is there a Professor Rice? And I said, yes, Bill. She said, you mean Abbott? And I never knew what the A stood for until she had mentioned that. But you've been known as Bill on the campus here.
I made that change between high school and college from my middle name to my first.
I see.
Which is all right. It's a convenience.
Now, was that a family name?
Yes, it's my mother's family
name. That's what I wondered. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I remember Sarah from the early days in Delaware. Her father was one of my father's colleagues at Ohio Wesleyan until Stevenson died prematurely.
Well, I just to digress a bit, your father came I remember staying with you here for a number of years until his passing. But was his father connected with Old Wesleyan in the East?
Yes, in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
He was the geology department there from, oh, probably 67 or some such time until about 1910 or so when he retired.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't get retirement date.
And then your father was at Ohio Wesleyan.
Yes.
And he was in biology, was it?
He was in zoology.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the chair of zoology was rather widespread. He taught some botany before he got a botanist in. He taught geology for a year before one of his old sidekicks, Westwick, came.
Mm-hmm.
Just as Lamb here was reported to have started out occupying the settee of natural sciences.
Right. That covered a lot in those days.
Yeah, and he covered it pretty well.
Yes, right. Well, what was your interest? You went into geology on your own? Did this background have anything to do with it?
Well, family background had something to do with it. My favorite professor, and I had known as far back as I can remember, because he was my father's close friend, was a geologist. I've always been interested in shapes and patterns and colors and textures.
Mm-hmm.
If I took a, well, I did take the Cooter test here once when we were giving, for the heck of it, a high interest in science, a still higher interest in art. And the two do overlap mm-hmm. in many respects. Both are a matter of design and pattern and fit.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you came, you were a one-man department, isn't that right?
Yeah, Matt was out of date then. And it took us a while to make the two-man department when Bob Weiss came in 64. And incidentally, all I did for Bob was showing the outcrops, the collections, which were a mess, and telling the boiling points of the executives insofar as I had discovered them. And he is the man who modernized the department, expanded and revised the curriculum. I was tied up in things like geography and the physical science course, which ran that was one of our temporary aberrations in curriculum.
That was a general education approach.
He is, it was long overdue that he was made officially head of the department. Heck, if you get a young man with new ideas, turn him loose.
What would your area be in geology? How would you describe your specialty or interests?
I never specialized. Of course, I grew up on fossil-bearing rocks in Ohio. I've been interested in landforms as their development, largely by erosion. My dissertation was on some old sedimentary and igneous rocks in Canada. Working for the TVA, I was sort of an off-breed mineralogist, both on our mineral raw materials and on the dangerous things that the chemists and engineers made by intent or by accident. Of course, you can handle a natural rocky substance or an artificial rocky substance by similar microscopic techniques.
Well, now to go back a minute, you indicated that Professor Lamb was occupying a pretty large chair in natural history. And although your catalog description read geology, there were many students who would have said it probably was a large cloak natural philosophy or some such title that that you occupied, because you didn't confine yourself just to shapes and of rocks and convolutions of the land. You touched on many subjects in your teaching. This is a part of your approach, isn't it?
Oh, I suppose it was. If you scatter yourself widely enough, occasionally you hit something. What is it they say? A specialist knows more and more about less and less, and he knows everything about nothing. A generalist knows less and less about more and more until he becomes mentally unbuttoned.
Well, I think many students, though, seriously felt stimulated because of this spread over into other fields and the trying on ideas, not just just rocks, but...
why not?
But I think this is a mark of an interesting and a good teacher, Bill.
Spotty, but it was fun. Of course, I learned a lot from those kids, too, including a few things that I shouldn't, and we learned a few things that
Well, I think it's the reports, and the students come back who ask about you and the stories they tell. It's been a colorful and stimulating teacher.
Just, before the efficiency experts got rid of all of the loopholes and pleasant interludes in our curriculum, and then we had chapel 2 days a week for two classes, 2 days a week for the other two classes. Of course, there was a period in the morning when half the campus was loose. And the snack bar is in the old fraternity house here off the corner of the campus, now the admin annex, or in the basement of Miller, certainly were built for Methodist togetherness.
Yeah.
And unless it was football or basketball season, and a couple of my colleagues and a couple of coaches were doing postmortems on the games, the conversation might go anywhere. No class distinctions between the freshmen and senior faculty members, and no great reverence. If it's interesting, let's look at it. It doesn't have to be a rock.
Right, and I suppose you spend as many hours drinking coffee as in the classroom, if you'd analyze it.
Yes, this is a confession, but as close to it. In fact, some of the classrooms have been in the coffee.
Well, it's an interesting atmosphere, and it does promote a good give and take like that. Did you know Charles Ketchum before you came to the college?
No, I didn't. I think I had heard the name, but he graduated from college just in time to be a chaplain in World War I. And I was born in 1912, and there was not much overlap in
right.
schooling. My father knew him, recognized the name. Of course, Nib was on the athletic committee, and catching was in track.
Mm-hmm.
What I know of his Ohio wrestling years, I've heard either from him or from my father since I came here.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know because of his connection whether you might have known about him or not, and it might have been one of the reasons that that you got in. Well,
that may have had some influence.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Ketchum played that perfectly fairly. Actually, for what Matt was offering then, there were not many candidates for the vacancy.
That's probably right. Well, now, Professor Lamb was still active and quite lucid when you arrived, wasn't he?
Moderately active. He would get out and work in his garden, and as I get older, I can begin to understand the pace of his research. He was quite lucid, extremely discursive, and it was rather hard to get a conversation to arrive at the point for a reasonable length of time, but clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some very interesting recollections, which I tried to write down, and I hope eventually to get a few bits and pieces of information edited from his, recorded in Ellsberg. See, now that I'm retired, I have a chance to throw away papers like this pile that I just gave you.
All right.
And every 100th paper is worth looking at and maybe annotating for posterity.
Well, I think, of course, Professor Lamb was here. I think after him was Cooper, and then there was Osborne Fuller, and then a fellow by the name of McKnight, and then I think you were the next person.
Yeah. Seems to me that Cooper went to Ohio Wesleyan for a couple of years from here.
I don't know where he
went. Yeah, that's where I knew him.
I see.
In fact, he and Westgate worked out a paper there.
Mm-hmm.
Fuller went to Ohio State, and it was during Fuller's stay that Lamb was officially retired. That would be in the very early 40s.
Yes.
Knight, I think, ran less than a year here. This was in the show.
During the war years.
During the war.
Right.
I think he asked to be relieved of his contract practically in mid-term. Certainly in mid-year.
But what I was going to point out, that for the length of time that the subject has been taught, there have probably been fewer people in that department than any other department on campus.
Yes, and I still say it should get more emphasis. I thought we had it going. I figured that when I retired, they could get in a full-time young sport. In fact, I'm not so sure I would have retired if I hadn't seen that possibility. We were running about a 2.5-man department there, and
oh, I forgot to mention Percy Strong was here.
Percy Strong came on and was doing a good job in paleo, and then practically, all in a matter of, at once, the department was cut to about a man and a quarter. A man and a rented course from somebody off campus, which of course does not add to the faculty.
Right.
It adds to the teaching, but not to the faculty.
I suppose, though, there is a pattern. I think Hiram gave up geology long ago, didn't they? A number of years back. They have not done anything.
They never let geology grow at a full stature up there, and part of it was handled by a man who was essentially a biologist. I think most of it was.
And I think someone told me just this spring that Marietta was giving up their petroleum emphasis down there, which had been one of their strong points for many years.
That was a separately funded affair.
Oh.
I don't know what it was, but it is independent of the geology department.
I see.
And I think it was rather long in petroleum engineering, and I doubt if it ever rose to the stature of schools like Tulsa, couple in Texas, and so on.
But I think over the years, though, I just pointed that out, that Mount Union had a distinction for the emphasis that it did have. Now, you may have thought it should have more, but the emphasis it did have.
Push.
Yes.
Lamb was pushed around by his colleagues, and I can see why. And there were attempts in my early years. I was less polite about them. And colleges are tending to play the numbers game. If you can get more noise out of a tuba, you buy a tuba instead of a flute.
Well, I don't know what, certainly you would think with space exploration, with the critical area and minerals, that some people would think just on practical grounds this would justify some emphasis on geology.
I think that geology is one of our salvation sciences. Partly for minerals, which you mentioned, and some of the technological buys to the contrary, we are not going to find substitutes. We're going to learn how to do without on some of these things. Now, if it comes to a fuel, we can make substitute out of corn husks expensively. But even more, in terms of the nature of the geologic process, what is going on the surface of the ground? Can we afford to take this ground out of agriculture and pave it, or put high-rise apartments on it? What about our surface and underground water supplies? This is as important as ecology. In fact, it is the substrate for biological ecology, as any ecologist can tell you. And in the geologic process, we deal with the surface and near surface movement of materials under various conditions. A botanist cannot operate without a geological substrate, and incidentally, the green stuff growing on top of it actually modifies all of the processes that are going on in and shortly below the soil, and the erosional process, which is obvious. No, it ought to be part of the educated person's common sense, and it used to be.
Well, maybe with the emphasis.
Geography was not dissolved in social studies.
Yeah.
In the grade school, it's got some rudimentary geology.
Maybe with this thrust at Harvard, the emphasis that Harvard and some other schools are trying to make on more of a core curriculum, maybe we'll have something of that coming back. It'll even,
well, I might hope so.
Even affect us here eventually, and we'll catch up with that. Something else I'd like to touch upon. I think during your career here, you've been a gadfly in the best sense of the word, not only at faculty meetings, but in the Dynamo and other places on the campus. And I think you've not only taken a great relish in it, but it's been something that's been needed on many occasions.
For that best sense of the word. My motives have been mixed, Joe. Sometimes I've been a gadfly because I thought it had to be done, and sometimes I did it in the same way that a small boy throws pebbles in the pond to watch the ripples. There's a certain amount of experimental deviltry in that. Well, yes, any small, closed community tends to become absurd. In fact, I'm not sure the whole world is absurd, but if somebody presents a different viewpoint, then some of the absurdities show up. You know, I had the most fun in class. I would simply bring the globe in, mount it upside down on its spindles, and the kids would say, "You've got it upside down." I said, "What do you mean upside down? Which hand is up?"
I remember years ago when we used to have freshman receptions. You remember at the beginning of the year, and the faculty would line up and meet all the freshmen.
Oh, the gauntlet.
Yes, and on one occasion, the faculty had gathered early before the, or some of the faculty, and you were one of the ones, and you came in, remember, to the reading room of the library, and there were three or four other people in there, and you jumped up and clicked your heels and let out a war whoop, and you said, "I've always wanted to yell in a library reading room." And I was interested in the reaction. It, being a librarian, it didn't bother me in the least, but two or three other people said, "That's that Bill Rice. You'd think in a library he'd know better." And they just, I mean, the sense of convention, you know, they just couldn't. But afterwards, one of them came around and said, "I didn't want to say it at the time, but I've always wanted to do the same thing, but I just didn't have nerve enough to say it out."
Little Bobby Stoddard. He's the only one radical enough in that crowd. I deny that story, Yost. I have no recollection.
Don't you?
I think you dreamed it.
No, that's all. I'd swear to that. I verified that. Yeah.
Add it to the legend.
I'll add it to the legend. Right. Right. Well, speaking about legends on the campus, three or four years ago, I was talking, and a number of students, and I said, I think this is an age of conformity, and faculty have become conformists. And I said, as I look back when I was a student, there was Isaac Taylor Hedlund, and there was Pop Eckler, and Mary Eckler, and there were a number of others, and I said, they were what we'd call characters, and I just don't think there are characters on the campus today. And the students all sort of smiled and said, "Well, you just aren't with it. There are still characters."
I remember that. And I might have stood there laughing.
Yeah.
No, you laid yourself open on that, Ghost.
But I suppose that maybe being a part of the establishment, you don't view it in quite the same way. What I was going to lead up to, in your experience here, if there were individuals who have come and gone, administration or faculty, that you consider to be distinctive or unusual in any sense like that.
Well, first, when I came here, perhaps the legends on the campus were Patty Pappenhagen, who ran a chemistry department very skillfully, and Frosty Schallenberger, who was sort of a bull in the woods and tried to terrify people occasionally. We got along fine. And Bill Morgan, who in addition to a very level-headed job on campus, which I'm sure you have recorded and should, been a power in the community for sobriety in the broader sense of the term, and the Ecklers. And I liked them all. I might say that one of that crowd, one of those no longer living, offered us some wine in our early years here in the summer afternoon. We were sitting on the front porch. And they brought it to us in teacups and said, "We have wine glasses, but we're afraid the then dean might draw it all high up. We'd just as soon have him think we were drinking tea." Which was all right with me. It tastes very much the same either way.
Well, of course, I remember when...
And Bob Stauffer, whom I never had quite the nerve to call Bob Stauffer until... later, was a very quiet and yet very effective influence for clarity and intellectual integrity on the campus. I'm sure that I'm missing some. Of course, it was Dolly and Martha Engel, and Engel had done a good job in teaching anatomy and probably never gotten full credit for it.
That's right.
I said Dolly and Martha. Mm-hmm. I said Omer and Martha. And Martha, I guess, did a lot of work for you in the library.
This cataloger.
What I remember most was when they were putting on Medea in the basement of Chapman in an improvised stage, and they didn't have enough backstage room, so some of the cast spilled over through the steam tunnel into the then new library basement for more dressing room. Martha Engel paged the elevator one day in the garage half full of naked Greek water.
Yes, I remember when they used the basement. That was quite a classic setting, too, for that production.
Yeah, I missed that because we had the Prince of Medea that year.
Mm-hmm. It was quite good. No, I remember when John Gannell, it was before your time, just at the early 40s, when he came, he wanted to do some Noel Coward sophisticated comedies, and of course there was profanity and also cocktails, and Charles Ketchum said, you know, this will have to be tea, and you might have one dam, but you'll have to cut out all the rest of the dialogue, and John Gannell was just beside himself. He'd gone to Yale to workshop there, and but he had to conform, had to do that to
well,
put
I
it on.
Well, I suspect that was true. This place was, at least on the surface, rather straight-laced when I came.
Yeah, it was still, yes, very much.
The GI stretched some of the lacing. And they also stretched the bounds of the faculty because they would not take bull.
Yes. But I think it's interesting in that connection that Melvin Hyde, who probably still carried this concept of a very Victorian straight-laced operation. Later on, when he retired as president at Evansville and came back, he used to laugh and smile about it. He said, if I were here, I would do it much differently. But at that time, this was a different experience for him. And,
well, Melvin was pretty young to be a dean, overworked. Mm-hmm. He ran a tight ship.
Yes.
He dragged me from here to breakfast a couple of times. But he had a good deal of respect and liking for him, as well as disagreement. And he mellowed as he became older, surer of himself. I think he was a swell college president.
I'm sure. When he left, he called me over and gave me some letters that he had received, and he said, put these in a historical file to be opened in 30 years when the people are no longer. And he said, these are letters that I would have fired off a real sharp retort to when I first came. But he said, I've learned to sort of take the punches and live with that. And as you say, when he left, he was beginning to mellow at that point. Well, we had Bill Leslie after that, and then Francis Christie, and that was a time with Christie that many people felt we were going to intellectually reform things and put some things in motion, but they never just really got far enough. At least they didn't do what we had hoped.
Well, I think that is true. I did not get any intellectual stimulation from Wesley. I got a tremendous amount from Francis Christie. So I think did the whole faculty. And I think part of the trouble right in there was that Mount was looking in two directions. One was toward academic excellence. And I hate to put it crudely, but the other was towards prettified architecture and decor. Mm-hmm. And my impression is well-grounded that there was a budgetary pull both ways there. Some good faculty members left, partly because they couldn't get what they needed here. God, a good deal of the decor that was inflicted upon us has been quietly disposed of or worn out.
Yes, attrition has taken
care of the money that went into it, but the aesthetic corruption of the students was what irked me.
Well, that was...
Bill Morgan ran a holding operation in the dean's office and did it very well. Was he right after Christie or was he after Bernie?
He was after Bernie.
Well, Bernie did not stay long enough to make a major impress on the campus,
right.
So in a sense we ran through his career on momentum, and Morgan, quite rightly, was not instituting new policies. He was getting the machinery in working order where it needed oil. And I got a funny byplay on that one day. I did something in connection with an irregular appearance at an exam for a student. And I simply called up Morgan and told him what I'd done. Well, he must have had one too many students that day. And he said, I had no right to do that. I think he was off base, but I said, well, I'm sorry, but I've already done it. I'm an error. I won't do it again. He had to make a great many decisions very fast. And you see the effect. We had about 4 years there where we did not have the continuity that could have led to, shall we say, a recognition of the academic excellence that we have for the most part had, but have never been able to sell because we were selling buildings and style and a homely place. And we went through some curriculum revisions. Now, no school should ever have to go through a major curriculum revision. It simply means that you've got something like a thermostat which does not respond rapidly enough. You should go through steady curricular revisions.
Now we're on.
All right, do you remember where the tape came out?
Oh, I think you were talking there about the publicity release.
Oh, a recent graduator had become a large part of our publicity department. It was during the interviews of faculty, and he went around to the Eckler's house. And he had two faculty members to interview there. They both had books all over the place and climbing the walls and orderly shelves, and there were books that the Eckler's had looked into, hundreds of them. More books than this kid had seen in all of his life. And the publicity came out that Professor Eckler was an expert on George Meredith, which was true. He has read all of George Meredith's novels. He has read 37 books. And we could have just said, yes, he read 37 books. I used to persuade students to read the book, and one girl, the daughter of a colleague and a senior, said, that is the first book I have read in college. I couldn't. She enjoyed it. But I couldn't quite twist her arm into reading another.
Well, I don't know. This is something that's baffled me from the time I've been here. What we can do, the atmosphere in this campus. There are other campuses where there's a different ethos, and that's just a part of it. But here, it's almost looked down upon by a great many, if you do
this. Yes, it is. Well, I have heard freshmen being counseled. This is a party school, and I have heard that by staff as well as by students acting as counselors and students just in a blind, shall leave the blind and both shall fall in the pit. They were vernacular conversations. Now we've sold ourselves short.
Well, we were coming up on the progression there. Administratively, I'm not trying to have you make a comment on that, but I'd just be interested in your relationship with DeBoe, who was a different kind of dean than any we had before or have had since, probably. DeBoe Freed. Or if you want to make no comment, we'll let it go at that.
I liked him very much. Respected and admired him. I think in some respects he had an impossible position. He knew in detail what was going on this campus. And he did it by walking around and talking with people and listening to people. He scared me one day. I was practicing the bass part, something, and I'd be singing in the corral over in one of the cubby holes in the music hall. I'd take it out of the house out of courtesy to the family until I learned the tune. I just about fell off the piano stool. There was this man peering in the door. 3 o'clock of a Sunday afternoon, curious to see what was happening. I think he brought us too much of the efficiency and the proper procedure. God knows we needed it, some of the efficiencies and some of the procedures, and he did stimulate certain of the services on the campus to function this year instead of next. Of course, I'm a little bitter here because he tipped Percy Strong out of geology into quarter time or something like that in admissions. At the quarter time was about third quarter before we saw what was left of Percy. But I think this accounting of how many student hours does a professor teach on the campus is ultimately self-destructive on a campus. And I remember, I'm not picking on sociology, but we had an argument that the sociology department should be allowed to put in some new courses because they had a large growing program. And I got the dean to strike that out, and I think he'd written it. That it was not a department's function to grow indefinitely, it was the school's function to pass judgment on what it should be doing collectively. As far as the program that was requested was concerned, it was okay. I'd be glad to vote for the program, but I would not be willing to vote for it if it was justified in those terms. Sorry, as thought of it afterward, one might say this is a fine cancer, let's feed it.
Well, it's interesting you make the observation that DeBoe went around, and no one on the administration for years at least had done that.
Christy did.
Yes, but this was a period of time. But someone on the faculty was pointed out when DeBoe, when it was pointed out DeBoe was doing this and listening, and said, the only other person on the faculty who does this is Bill Rice, which is an interesting comparison at that. And I think that's something that you did over the period of years you were here. You listen not only to students just in your major in geology, but you listen to students in music and over to center and other places you met them.
Well, the basement was too damn cold. I had to get a cup of coffee to get warm.
Well, I'm sure that's an excuse, but that's not the real reason. But I think you...
curiosity.
Yes. But I think it was a good leavening, and many of the rest of us were too busy or too formal. Yes, I think Chick did some of that.
He has his eye out. You'd be surprised where Bob knows that he shouldn't. And there are people doing that all the time. And you see, it's accidental that I'm in science. I entered college as an English major. Let's say it's a hereditary disease. Yeah. I practically flipped a coin with zoology. In a different environment, I might have grown up as an instrument designer. In fact, I did some of that with the TBA, and I flirted with Fisher Scientific. Now I'm retired. I laid linoleum. I have fixed plumbing. I've done things to the house that are overdue, and that and I really couldn't afford to hire them done. Some of them I could not get done for any price.
Well, I think this is true today.
Well, you learn that in the laboratory. Yeah. Right. After all, if you can fix the microscope, you ought to be able to fix the kitchen faucet.
At the prices today, you'd better fix it yourself.
Yes. The alchemist's dream to turn lead into gold. The Columbiars have done it.
That's right. Boy,
it's simply that having never highly specialized in any one thing, I'm sort of specialized in unspecialization. think this has a certain amount of survival value.
Right. Right. Well, I think the one girl came into the library one time and was surprised and a bit shocked, and yet was quite amused and taken by it. And she said, "Professor Rice came into the classroom and he didn't come in through the door, he came in through the window."
Oh, yes, that was when Wilson had not been shotgun welded to Lamburn.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming to the campus from the west. There's a windowsill at ground floor level, and a climber's long step down to the floor, spring day. Windows open, glass is in there. Interestingly enough, though, that story has followed me with embellishments right up to Wilson 219 and how
is
I come in the second story window of a building that has no windows. Remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, that's how the myths and legends grow on that.
Yeah.
But I remember this girl came up and that afternoon when it had happened. What about some of the students? Were there foreign students here that particularly struck you, or just regular native Buckeye students? Or did you find them rather homogenous and occasionally a free thinker?
Well, yeah, Shippy Sharpneck was a senior when I came.
That's right.
She'd been promised geology next year ever since her freshman year. And in that same class, there was a pre-ministerial student who asked me after our first lab, a little walk around on the campus, was there any scientific evidence whatsoever in favor of the so-called theory of evolution? And I decided I better come in swinging on that. I said, yeah, there's so much evidence that people who know anything about it take it not as a theory, but as a law. And I thought, my gosh, if there are a thousand more like him, it'll be interesting. But Andy Brasco was there, and though he majored in physics, he went on in geology. Shippy was there, and she was present wherever there was a philosophical argument. And a kid by the name of Reynolds was there, and they let into him. So we sat all five of us on the grass, and all he did was moderate for 2 hours. So finally, he says, "I can tell you one thing." I said, "Sure, go ahead." He says, "You know how many ribs a man has?" And I says, "No, do you?" Well, he didn't know either. He says, "Well, I don't know, but I know he has one less than a woman." And I looked at him and I said, "You better walk over to that building and go up and consult the skeleton. You have said something that all of the people who have performed autopsies, dissections, skeletal mounts, and so on have never discovered, and I don't believe there's a word of truth in it." Though occasionally a person has one too many or one too few ribs. But there were arguments then. There have been arguments about religion on this campus. And in my early years, I met the occasional person who were shocked by evolution. Just as my father had met them at Ohio Wesleyan, and I think the clientele here, when I came, was philosophically, in terms of most other things, of the question of evolution, and conservative to a level of more like what I had known at Ohio Wesleyan before World War II, or even before that. In other words, they had more rural and more from the hills. And pure city sophisticates on the campus in those years. So I had to help a couple of kids. I didn't make them believe in evolution. In fact, I made a treaty with one, George. He's going into the ministry, and he was very conservative. You don't have to believe this, but you might as well know that it is a widely entertained theory, and you might be able to know what the devil's argument is when you can confront it. Well, it was George Hampshire.
Oh, George, yes.
And he was not scared of Professor Devil, and because it might buck about once a week on the argument of class, and I never knew whether who was going to win the argument. He was skillful. He pulled an A in the course. Best semester we ever had in historical geology because George sharpened the argument.
Yes, it would.
And there were various reprehensible characters that I thoroughly enjoyed. I believe some of them nameless. Some awfully funny things happen on the college campus. Just we don't have a TV and we don't listen to the radio. Why should I pay money and spend time looking for funny things when I can walk across the campus? You just have to see funny things, and when somebody points them out to you in a TV program and underlines them with grease paint and the yellow magic marker saying joke, laugh, spoiled all the fun of it.
Well, Dr. Hedlund, who taught here for many years, had a philosophy of life that he was quite noted for. But one of the precepts that he had was he would not pay money to go to theaters or motion picture because he could meet great ideas, the greatest minds in books. He could sit at home and do this. Why should he pay money to go down to some second or third rate operation? And he said, you just save your money. This is what he admonished students.
Well, this is interesting, but sort of too bad to miss some of the great ideas that spill over in Shakespeare. Didn't he even make an exception there?
No. He was a Methodist to the point that he said, I never go to a theater, and do you know why? Because there are painted women around the stage doors, and you are corrupted morally, so you stay away from theaters. No, he was quite a Methodist moralist at this point.
Yes, I can see back to that, Joost. See, my grandfather was a minister, and I loved geology and thought evolution rather early. I know something of the Methodist tradition. And I might say that some of it was hanging on this campus amongst the pre-ministerial students. The bright kids like Rufus and Douglas and there's another one in that crowd wanted to revive the Hedlund Club, which was, there was no great credit to Hedlund at the time. Mm-hmm. They were the forward-looking young ministers. And I said, how many of you are there? And they said, well, about 16 of us who can't stomach it. Well, less than that many in the Hedlund Club. I said, why don't you join them and outvote them?
Yeah.
And they tried it and they couldn't take it. And really, I think there are places where the Methodist tradition, here within my memory, and perhaps even now, has gotten a little bit stuck in its rules. And the rules have become empty. And perhaps it is not the rule that we want, but something that might be considered by the old term good taste, common sense, courtesy, good form, self-respect, respect for your fellow man, which is where rules start out, and then they get petrified.
Well, you should be on the campus now because there's a resurgence of what I suppose we'd call fundamentalism. And
yes, three of them were praying for me when I was here on campus, and I thanked them for it because I think they were doing it in courtesy and good faith. And
you should have been at the last faculty meeting because there was quite a discussion. Of course, the last meeting of the year, and everyone was, or I should say, many, going very philosophical over some of the minor points that aren't too important, but there was a constitution up for discussion, a constitution of the little flock. This is a religious group, and they wanted to be approved. And there were some individuals who thought this had very sinister overtones, and they were questioning. I didn't speak out. I felt like Mo Tse-tung, who one time said, let 100 flowers bloom. I think the more they have like that, the better. It isn't going to hurt anything. But
you know what's interesting? I said the brownie catch in my first year here when we were on the, I guess we were on the Religious Life Committee. He was a student, and I was a faculty member. I said, brownie, this is a secular campus. He said, how right you are. There were a few people that I would call religious fossils.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute literal interpretationists, like my friend who wanted to know if there was any evidence for evolution. For the kids who prayed for Dick Scott, he heard about his evolution and historical geology, his pre-ministerial. And they tried to read him out of the pre-ministerial group, and they were praying for him. And I said, Dick, they're not praying for you. They are committing intellectual assault and battery on your side. Forgive them if you can and ignore them in the meantime. Well, now, I didn't feel that way about the kids who were praying for me. But they were not trying to force me. I didn't think that Kappa Phi would go on this campus. It's going great guns. I don't know, I may have voted for a constitution for ICTHUS or something like that. I think the splinter group is somewhat like the splinter groups, and I've had some contact with the all the counterculture of communes and natural foods and so on. It's partly a revolt against an establishment which does creak in places. On campus, God knows it creaks in the town, in the state, in the nation. It creaks unnecessarily. But they want to go off and withdraw from the daily business of the communal society, and I'm not sure what a bunch of these little religious groups are sort of like small clubs of kids out in the shrubbery, hiding from the grown-ups and hiding from the big boys down the alley, and they're not quite willing to live in the world and contaminate themselves by it. Tsang has a footnote somewhere in the Importance of Living. A high monk in China, unlike the ordinary monk of the monastery, goes back into the world, eats dog meat, drinks wine, talks to prostitutes and other sinners, like Jesus. Well, I think it would be better if they joined some of the existing groups, of which what kinds of Protestants do we have? There ought to be enough already without inventing some new ones. Join someone of those and leaven it, and if they find themselves contaminated by the world, then go take a bath.
Well, I suppose for many of them, it's a part of the growing up process, and they have to go through this. It's an experience for them.
I am very much amazed by this whole, for the past 4 or 5 years, religion has been spreading on the college campuses. and it has been spreading nationally, and I might say that both on the campus and in the nation, some of it is healthy and some of it is in acute virulent forms.
Well, I suppose where there's a vacuum, nature abhors that, and it's an attempt on the part of many people to try to do something at this point with the problems that face them and with the pressures that they have.
You just have to live,
right? I know, but these are pressures that...
There is no pie in the sky, and there's no use dreaming yourself up the idea that there is. I think a lot of it is an outflow from a feeling of general insecurity. We're all insecure.
Right.
But I'm not going to sit on my body because I might be run over by a truck or shot by a raven, or I might die of boredom sooner by checking myself from all of these things.
Well, there were some individuals who came on about the time that you did. Glenn Clark was one.
Yes, and I wish you'd gotten history on him. Good man, Glenn. And of the church.
That's right. He's very much so. Very much so. And a very stabilizing influence in the faculty.
Very level-headed. Very clear. Although he and Paul Chapman, head of English, entertained me one day. They were trying to reword a sentence, and they made every word in it before they got to the right. Our clearest mathematician. Well-spoken, literate head of English. It was one of those problems where you just couldn't seem to get to the right part. Yeah. Glenn was a pleasure. So was Stoney, and of course...
Right. Well, you're referring to Stonecipher now, just for the sake of the record.
He took his work too seriously and then killed himself by overwork. Temperamental overwork, as much as anything.
I was talking to Mr. Lamb the other day, and he said, you know, someone was talking to me a while back, and he referred to Stoney, and he said, I didn't know who they were talking about.
Well, any of the students of Stoney's day is a record.
That's right.
Stonecipher.
Yeah.
They owed him a lot, too.
Right.
Right. They better come back and endow the college with the
room
to learn
from Stonecipher. Right.
Okay, name some others.
Oh, it was John
Saffel. I can't remember whether John came before
He did. I think just in the summer, and you came in that fall, the next spring.
The other way around.
Maybe. Maybe he came in the fall. I'm not sure.
I had priority over
it could be.
Commencement procession.
Could be.
Well, that is a stimulating mind.
And a good sense of humor.
A very sharp sense of humor. John and Helen both.
Right.
A pleasure.
And, of course, since, I guess, Mom and Pop Eckler, we have no combination like that on the campus. That's our
home. I sort of took to them as parental figures, really. Mm-hmm. As I guess many of the students on campus did.
And probably we won't have any combinations like that, with the administrative laws being what they are. You can't, and that's true not only here, but in other institutions as well. So it's a...
Yeah. Well, I think that was a matter of temperament. That was a rare combination,
right,
even when it was quite possible.
Right.
Yeah, and I suppose I have seen, in about 5 years, I was halfway up the commencement procession, which indicates the turnover.
Yeah.
I've seen an awful lot of good faculty come through here. And, find themselves dead-ended or underpaid or inappropriate to the place, and sometimes they find it out, and sometimes we find it out, and sometimes we make mistakes on it. But I've seen times here when we did not have what you ought to have in a faculty. a relatively small proportion of older ones, a large middle group, and some youngsters coming in. In other words, we had a bunch of 1, 2, and 3 years on the campus people, and the classic crowd that we started out with in our discussion, and Don Little in between.
Yes, this is true. Of course, everything's been pretty much frozen now because of the economic situation.
Yes, and I'm not sure that it would have been frozen because of excessive caution.
This is true. But this is pretty much true on every campus.
I know it's true on every campus.
Yeah. I can't tell. We're getting down to the near the end. Do you have a parting word of wisdom or a colorful recollection that you want to record for posterity? Okay.
All right, after many unprintable words of conversation, thinking of something, one thing that I have sensed here is missing. I grew up on the Ohio Wesleyan campus. My father was pretty well along in years when I became aware of the campus. And I knew that that campus was essentially run by the faculty. That faculty had continuity through some rather sad administrative changes, and it still does, and it has survived. And I asked my father, when did the faculty take over the leadership of Ohio Wesleyan? He says, I don't know. It was largely done when I came. I think that was in 1899. And I think that that is something that Mount should consider. We have a terrific faculty here, really, better than we know. But it has been only under rare circumstances. Part of the time under Christie was a golden age when the faculty had what I would consider to be not merely its proper share, but one of its proper functions in determining the shape of the college and its policies. You see, administrators can come and go, and a whole college president can leave, but even in a bad year, you don't change more than a third of the college faculty. So there is continuity, and yet there is always new blood coming in. And they should be, I think, the body politic.
This afternoon is June 21st, 1978. I'm seated in my office in the college library.
Some others.
Oh, it's John Saffel.
I can't remember whether it's possible.
Right.
Yeah, and
word of wisdom or colorful recollection that you want to record for posterity. Okay.
All right, after many unprintable words of conversation, thinking of something, one thing that I have sensed here is missing. I grew up on the Ohio Wesleyan campus. My father was pretty well along in years when I became aware of the campus. And I knew that that campus was essentially run by the faculty. That faculty had continuity through some rather sad administrative changes, and it still does, and it has survived. And I asked my father, when did the faculty take over the leadership of Ohio Wesleyan? He says, I don't know. It was largely done when I came. I think that was in 1899. And I think that that is something that man should consider. We have a terrific faculty already, better than we know. But it has been only under rare circumstances, part of the time under Christie was a golden age, when the faculty had go, and a whole college president can leave, but even in a bad year, you don't change more than a third of the college faculty. So there is continuity, and yet there is always new blood coming in. And they should be, I think, the body politic.
That's